Today's episode of The Overwhelmed Brain is brought to you by a company that caters to your listening preferences. I'm talking about Audible. Head over to audible.com/brain and get your free book and a 30-day trial membership today. An unmatched selection of audio programs available. Are you annoyed by affirmations? Are you jaded by all the same old been there, done that self-help programs that all seem to boil down to telling you to
think positively?
Depression is an excuse and anxiety is just an attention getter. As long as you think positively, you'll find that there's no emotional problem that you can't tackle.
Depression is an excuse?
Hey, there's my ride. Don't call me, I'll call you.
If affirmations feel like lies and positive thinking feels like a straight path to denial, then get ready to start creating the life you want now. Hello, this is Paul Coliani, personal empowerment coach and host of The Overwhelmed Brain, and this is the personal growth show for the critical thinker. On every episode, we'll talk about practical down-to-earth steps to help you improve your mood and keep you sane in this powerful journey we call life. I want to help you bridge the gap between your emotions and reason, causing you to discover why you do the things you do and what you can do to reach higher levels of happiness and lower levels of stress and overwhelm. Everything I talk about in this show should not be mistaken for actual medical advice or treatment and is intended to be for informational and educational purposes only. Always consult a physician before making any changes to your medical treatment. What you will find here is an increase in your emotional intelligence, a strengthening of your self-worth and self-esteem, the motivation to be your authentic self, and the forward momentum to help you learn, heal, grow, and evolve. All right, I have a great subject matter to talk about. That is reflective of what I talked about last week, or at least a letter that I read last week. And instead of explaining it, I'm going to read another letter that I got that talked about last week's episode. And I'm just going to read you a couple pieces here. And it says, I just wanted to let you know that I love your show, and it has opened me up to much healing and understanding of myself. While the show has been great, I was disappointed at the racially charged email that you read in this most recent episode. The person who emailed you mentioned that she's only attracted to black men, and I'm assuming she is a white woman, and the fact that her mentioning a black man brought on a discussion of many baby mamas, jail, and so forth. Being that the podcast is led by a white male and the majority of the audience is white, which I'm not sure where she gets that information. In fact, let me look at my media kit. Do I have listener demographics that actually say if they're white or not? I don't really care about that information, but let me look. Let's see, I have average income, I have age, marital status, education, gender. This is from a survey that I took a while back regarding the show listeners. I don't have anywhere on my page that, on my media kit page, that tells me that anyone is of any color or nationality. And personally, I honestly don't care. I don't really think about it. I don't think in terms of that. What I do have that I guess might be a little discriminating is I have a mostly female audience. 26.5% male, 73.5% female. Now, those numbers may have changed. Those are probably about a year old now. But it's probably very similar. But no, I can't find anywhere where she got that information that the audience is mostly white. Regardless, I just want to address that. But she goes on to say that I believe race in this instance should have been omitted or treated differently. She goes, I'm not blaming you for the email that was sent to you, and I understand these things can be tricky to deal with, but I wanted to point it out because while it wasn't anything overtly inappropriate, it didn't sit well with me, and it actually made me painfully aware of the demographic of your listeners. She goes on to say, but it also motivated me even more to bring this topic up to you, and maybe so that one day you might have a teaching moment for your listeners on treating minorities as others and assuming Anglo-Saxon heteronormative reality is the only legitimate one. I know this sounds like a lot of rambling. I'm having a hard time collecting my thoughts and expressing in an understandable way why this is problematic for me. But I hope you can understand, and I don't blame you for this. It's just an overlooked aspect of the podcast, which could make more people of color like me feel more included and understood. Thank you so much, Michelle. She wrote to me. She checked, said, yes, you can use my name on the air. So I'm going to use her name, Michelle. I appreciate you for sharing this. And as always, if there's any type of controversy or negative aspect of the show that someone mentions, like a negative review, or in this case, hey, why are you being insensitive here? I mean, that's the message I'm getting. I want to know about it. And I want to address it on the air as fast as possible. And I did write back to her. And, you know, I thanked her for expressing this. And absolutely, if she heard me this way, someone else did too. So if you're listening and you were offended by the last episode where I read a letter that said the words baby mama and jail and other things, if that at all offended you, I apologize. I'm not going to make excuses, but I will tell you why I said some of the things I said. First of all, I read the letter pretty much as is, with omissions, as always, just to keep any personal information out. And that was the language the letter writer, Sandy, used. Now, if you've ever coached with me, or if you understand how I do this show, when someone writes to me, or someone coaches directly with me, I will often use their language to communicate back with them. And that is an important point. It doesn't necessarily mean that I agree or that that's how I talk, but I will absolutely use their language so that it helps them relate and think in a way that they already think. For instance, Michelle's like, you're using the term baby mama. And I think I did use that term, like baby mama number one, baby mama number two. And to her, it sounded like that's how I talk. Like, you got some guy out there who's got several baby mamas. I don't know if you've ever heard this show, but that's not necessarily how I talk. I don't even like the term baby mama, quite honestly, because it does diminish the person that's being referenced. In the sense that there's a real woman out there with real emotions who probably believed she was in a real relationship that was going to last. And she's creating a life with this person. And now some guy out there just said, yeah, that's my baby mama. It depersonalizes the woman. It de-identifies the woman as being a real person with real feelings. And I wanted to address this right up front because there are things that I might say on the air sometimes that are really focused on the person who wrote the letter, even though what I'm talking about and maybe what I'm teaching at the time will affect hundreds or thousands of other people. But especially in this case, when it comes to terminology or words that are typically attributed to some sort of a stereotype by the way people talk, I usually don't have to think about being sensitive about that because I don't talk that way at all. I don't even bring up terms like that because it's not in my normal vocabulary when I'm speaking in regular life, when I'm not on the air. And it's not that I fault anyone for using those terms at all. Anyone can use any terms they want as long as they're not hurting other people. If you're in a private conversation with someone else and you're using terms that I might not use or maybe even find offensive, that is between you and the other person. But if other people can hear it, you're probably going to offend someone. Even if you're using good terms, you know, quote, good terms, you could be saying, that Caucasian man over there is really tall. You could say something like that. And the Caucasian man that you're talking about might hear it and go, why are they even identifying me as Caucasian? Why does color even come into play? They might get offended, even though you were using the appropriate term. Sometimes you can't win. It's true. Sometimes you can't win. And everything I'm saying right now has, you know, nothing against the letter writer from last week, because that's her language. That's how she spoke. And I respect that. I respect that about her. So when I talk back to her, I'm going to use language that she can relate to. So I might say things like that. However, with that said, since Michelle, who wrote the letter that I'm talking about right now in this segment, said that I'm having a hard time collecting my thoughts and expressing in an understandable way why this is problematic for me, that tells me there's something that I've triggered inside of her that's probably very deep and sensitive to subject matter like this. And I totally get that. I totally get that. And because of that, I will now be more aware that when I'm using language that is used by someone who writes to me, to inform you that this isn't necessarily how I talk in general or on the air. This is how I talk to that person so they can relate. It's like if you told me, I have a really square boss, he's dull, boring, and plain. And I said, so the square boss that you have, when he comes out of his office and yells at you, what's the first thing that you think of? I might ask a question like that on the air, addressing their specific term, square boss. But somebody else might hear that and go, that guy just called her boss square. And it's certainly, I think you get the point. It's certainly not something that I am intentionally calling someone else. It's all part of the language that someone uses. And that's a good message for anyone listening now, is that when you talk to someone and they're using certain words or verbiage that you don't necessarily use, it's also a good way to keep rapport with a person. If somebody comes up to me and say, hey, what's up? How's it going? How's it hanging? I'll go, hey, man, what's up? How's it hanging with you? You know, I might do something like that just because it just feels more natural to be in that vibe, to be in that space. Still, that's not an excuse. I need to be aware of social norms. And in that example, that might be a social norm that isn't found offensive by anyone. But in other cases, there might be something that goes outside the social norm and needs to be thought of. Like, I remember this time when my first long-term girlfriend and I were ballroom dancing, and we would go to an adult education class once a week. And there was an older lady there that was very sweet, and we really enjoyed her company. And as we would dance, we would take breaks, and then we would all talk. And she said something that offended me so deeply. I was in shock. And she was always pleasant and nice to be around. And it was a racial statement. She said something to the effect of, I don't want to be around that. And I'm not going to say the N-word, but she said it. And my girlfriend and I were in shock. We were like, what? I didn't know these people still existed that were so racist. And another woman was so much in shock, she was crying. And she was confiding in us and commiserating with us, like, I can't believe that, what's her name? I forget her name. That's okay. I won't say it on the air anyway. Said that, and I don't want to be associated with her. And we did stray away from her because it was just such a dysfunctional old perception that she brought in from a long time ago, that she was probably taught as a young kid to look at people a certain way, to look at a certain people in a certain way. And that builds a superiority complex in you when you look down at others. It can certainly offend people. It's like you're going to offend half the population when you put a pro-life bumper sticker on your car. You're also going to offend half the population when you put a pro-choice bumper sticker on your car. It's just, there's no way around it. In order to not offend, you don't say anything. If you don't want people to be upset with you, don't put any bumper stickers on your car. But when you take a stand and you take a side, you will offend people. Now, this doesn't really relate to what I'm talking about here, because those are extreme examples. But it does show you that even the smallest little thing can be taken as an offense and trigger someone at a deep level, just like I did with Michelle. So this is an awareness that I'm going to take with me. I consider this a learning lesson for me. It is absolutely something that I never thought twice about, because I don't think in terms of race. I don't think in terms of color. It just doesn't cross my mind. I'm sure there's an awareness of it deep inside of me. But when someone who's been listening to the show believes that I've been insensitive to that, or I've crossed the line somewhere, then I have to listen. I have to stand up and I have to accept responsibility that I probably did say something that was insensitive or somehow crossing the line somewhere. and that I will absolutely be more aware of that going forward. So thank you, Michelle. You expressed yourself. You shared it with me. You were even very tactful in how you said it. And I'm appreciative of you. And I want people to do this. I want you to do this. If you're listening, if you ever hear me say something that triggers you and offends you, let me know about it. Because I cannot come on the air and tell you, oh, I'm perfect. I'm over every single dysfunction that I've ever had in my life. I mean, that's what this show is all about, is discovering what dysfunctions or old beliefs or old patterns or old perceptions are still prevalent or still hidden. Not only prevalent, but hidden deep inside of you. If there's something still way in there that comes out, and maybe it's in language or behavior, when it comes out and somebody recognizes it and they go, what are you doing? And you go, what do you mean? What am I doing? That's terribly offensive. And you go, what? How is it offensive? You don't even know. You don't know it's there. So it's helpful to have people to express that to you. And don't take offense to what they say about what they see. Because if they see it, someone else does too. And I think that's vital to hold on to and understand about yourself. And for you to be open, and even if you feel a little offended by what they're noticing about you, it's an opportunity for you to go inside and go, do I have any old programs running that believe that? Is what they're saying true in any respect? Do I need to explore this in myself? And that's what I did today, as I explored what Michelle wrote to me, and I explored that about myself to find out, is there anything still there? And it was a perfect opportunity for any healing, learning, growing, and evolving. Because when that stops, then what's left? So thank you, Michelle. And thank you, Sandy, last week for just being open with your situation too. Because you have a right to express yourself in the way that you express yourself. Not everyone's going to agree. But that's just the way it goes. And you find this stuff out as you go along. So that's it for this segment. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back with Ask Paul right after this. One of my favorite pastimes is listening to the programs I want to listen to. I remember I used to drive an hour and a half to work and an hour and a half back. I did that for about 4 years. I did all I could to find radio shows that would either educate or entertain me, but my selection was really non-existent. And then I bought my first book on CD. It was a Star Wars novel called Rogue Planet. I listened to that story 2 or 3 times in just a few days. I loved it. Now we have the internet, and I can download stories like that to my phone. In fact, out of curiosity, I looked up Rogue Planet in Audible, and it was available. I'm thinking about taking that trip into the Star Wars universe once again, except this time, I won't need to swap out multiple CDs to hear one story. I just had a show recently on how we can use our brain in ways that actually makes us smarter and more creative. I truly believe that listening to audio not only helps us utilize the auditory processing area of our brain, but also the visual processing center of our brain too, because we're imagining the visuals of the story as it unfolds before us. I'm not saying that every book lends itself to that, but processing auditorily while creating in your mind visually is an excellent way to light up that creative spark in you. So maybe you can tell me, are you a more creative person when you're listening and creating images in your mind? Well, you can practice. Go to audible.com/brain. That's AUDIBLE.com. And make sure to use the /brain, because Audible will give you a 30-day trial along with a free book. And I just found out that Audible actually gives you a free book every month and unlimited access to channels content. I didn't realize that until now, so that's very cool. So I wonder what you're into. Is it science fiction or maybe nonfiction, which both sometimes cross paths quite often? Or maybe you're into autobiographies? I recently found out a little bit more on Martin Luther King Jr., and I was enthralled. His story is just incredible. I might have to download the MLK Jr. autobiography read by LeVar Burton. You know, that engineer guy on Star Trek. Check it out yourself. Go to audible.com/brain and download the title you want and start listening right away. Audiobooks, original audio shows, news, comedy, broadcasters, entertainers, magazines, newspaper publishers. All right, welcome back to Ask Paul. This is where I read a listener email on the air and do my best to help them through a challenge. Today's message is from a person I'll call Sarah. Sarah says, "Hi, Paul. I'm curious on your position of taking a separation during a relationship, like a move out of a shared home for a few months separation, but also continue to receive counseling together and work on things during that time. My boyfriend and I are at a crossroads of what our future holds. We've both been married before and we come with our own baggage, plus we've created some joint tension over time. He likes to say we have a great relationship with a lot of tension. We love each other very much, have a great bond, and we're very affectionate with each other. We started talking about the future and realized that there were some real things to work out before we got married. We have tried some things on our own, but it's been very difficult and unsuccessful. He suggested it was time for a break from living together. He believes space can be helpful to think clearly about things and break some codependency habits we have. What are your thoughts on this idea? I don't personally know success stories, but he said it worked for his parents. Have you seen success? Do you think it can be a good thing for a relationship? I enjoy your podcasts and articles, and they have proven to be very helpful when working through my anxiety issues. Thank you." All right, Sarah, that is an excellent question. In fact, I've talked about this on the air before regarding separating for the main reason that you are a heavy influence in someone's life. And when you are in the midst of dysfunction or other relationship issues, that it is very difficult sometimes to get out of that dysfunction and those relationship issues because you're in the middle of them. It's the equation that creates the dysfunction or the strife or whatever you want to call it. When you are a variable in that equation, you can't see the problem from outside the equation. Or, to not complicate it so much, when you're in it, you can't see it from an objective perspective. You can't see the problem because you're in the problem. It's sort of like when I first learned some skills in coaching other people. I wanted to coach myself. I'm like, wow, I'm learning all these skills and tools and techniques. Let's coach myself. And yes, some things do work. And today I've gotten a lot better at it. But when I first started, I was so wrapped up in the problem that I couldn't see objectively enough from outside the problem to help myself. It's sort of like, okay, tell me about your sadness. It is hard to step out of that sometimes, even though I teach that you can step out of your emotional state and then talk to yourself like your own coach or therapist. I absolutely teach that. And when that works, that's great. But when you're really in it, when you really have big problems, it's hard to dissociate from that. It's hard to get out of that, unlink yourself from the situation, especially when someone else is involved. If you lived alone and you had your own problems, it's a lot easier to step outside and just talk to yourself that way. But when someone else is there as a trigger, as a reminder, as an influence, and it's a constant thing because you're always together or you're in the same environment together, or their stuff is around the house and it's always reminding you of them, and or there are things that you have to do together or you have to wait for the other person with, it's just your life is enmeshed in theirs. So sometimes it's hard to work on yourself and your own problems when you're so enmeshed in someone else's life, which is why I highly encourage, yes, separating can be an excellent way to get out of the equation, to get away from the situation long enough to see it objectively. Because when you're away from something for a long enough period of time, where you're not constantly triggered day after day after day, then it gives you an opportunity to look at it from a different perspective. And having that different perspective helps you clear the fog. When you're in it, it's foggy, this emotional fog, and tension and pressure and stress is prevalent. But when you're out of it and you're on your own and you can look at it from that distance, the fog is lifted and you're able to see much clearer. Now, along with that, what's most important about a separation is that you are no longer influenced by the other person. I mean, imagine that. Imagine if you are living with someone now, married, partnership, whatever, and you come home and they're not home and you're thinking about dinner plans. I wonder what my partner wants for dinner. I wonder if he or she's going to pick up milk. I wonder if we're going to watch that TV show tonight. I mean, almost every thought you have involves your partner in some way. And your mind just gets wired to involve the other person. It becomes natural. So even when it comes to things like helping yourself, personal growth, working on your emotions, working on your issues, the other person's still in your mind, which means he or she's still in your thought processes. So everything you process in your mind includes them in some way. And when that happens and you reach a point where you can't get past a problem in your relationship, then you're stuck because you can't think outside of that box that you're thinking in now because they're in it. So how do I think differently? You take yourself out of the environment, out of the situation, and you're able to think differently. Now here's a reality check. The reality check is that once you are separated, whether that's voluntarily and we say, okay, let's just take some time apart and then work on ourselves and then we can bring a new improved self into the relationship and really go forward because we still love each other. I mean, that's the only way this is going to work anyway. If you don't have any feelings for each other, then separating probably won't rekindle those feelings. It could, but usually if the love has diminished to the point where you just want to get away from each other, then there's not much left to work on. It is possible. I'm not excluding it, but it is harder once you've reached that point. But if you're still in love with each other or really love each other enough to just make this work somehow, some way, then yes, separating is a good way to work on yourself, improve yourself, and bring a new improved you back. But the reality check is that you could be separated and realize that you're happier without that person in your life. That is a possibility. But I think it's important to have that option on the table. I think it's important to realize that if you two do separate, one of you could become closer and the other one could become farther, or you both could become farther. Those possibilities exist. So you need to ask yourself the question, are you ready to do whatever it takes to create a great relationship? Because your great relationship may not be with each other. And that's just vital to realize that what you're doing could essentially lead to your breakup. There's just as much chance of breaking up as there is as getting back together in a stronger, more powerful bond. That's a scary prospect, and you might think, well, maybe we shouldn't do it at all. There's too much risk. But that's where I ask the question, wait, why would you want to stay with someone that if you separated for a while, you realized you were happier without them? That means when you're with each other, there's some sort of repressed unhappiness that isn't brought to the surface and talked about. If that repressed unhappiness stays in the relationship, sure, one of you might be happy and in love, but the other person might be suffering. And holding that in, that repressed unhappiness, gets worse and worse and worse over time, and eventually it'll become stale and the love will be gone, and there could be no chance that you two get back together because the love is gone. Which is why I think it's good to get to a point where you're both healthy enough in a good enough space to separate, consider everything, work on yourself, work on your own emotional triggers, work on your own healing, and then see each other maybe every now and then or more, but be in a place in yourself where you have your own time to think, your own space to think. All of this is very important because a relationship only works when two people bring the best version of themselves into it. If you bring the baggage, like you're saying, Sarah, then you have to deal not only with your baggage, but his baggage that might trigger more of your baggage and vice versa. And it just continues in this vicious loop over and over again until you just can't stand each other, and then you split forever. So if you want this to work, separation is a good idea. I mean, if he suggested that separation is a good idea because his parents did it and that actually helped them, he might have a similar thought process, that we take time to ourselves, work on ourselves, and then come back together as new people. Now, I would establish ground rules because you don't want a misunderstanding. If you both separate and you feel like, okay, now that we're separate, we can work on ourselves, and he goes off and starts dating other people, that may not be part of your ground rules. That may not be part of your idea of building a healthier me. Because if you're going to separate and then go see other people, I mean, that can work if you both agree to it. I have no problem with that if you're both in agreement with it. Because sometimes it takes other people to give you an opportunity to reflect on what you already have. So if he's dating and you're dating and you come back and you go, wow, I have this great relationship, and that person I just dated doesn't compare, that could happen. That's if you go that route. I think it's a little risky to go that route because you introduce new elements into the reconciliation of you two. I mean, because you could fall for someone else, which still could be a good thing overall in the bigger picture, because if you're not in love with the person you're with and you fall for someone else and they have more of the characteristics that you want in your life and more maybe alignment with your values and they honor your boundaries and all that stuff, that could work out even better. But is the relationship you're in good enough to work on so diligently where you don't date other people? So dating other people, let me just say this, is an element that if you choose to include that, will stir the pot some more. That will throw some more randomness into what you get back when you get back together. Personally, a personal opinion, not a professional opinion. My personal opinion is it's a bad idea to date while you're separated if you're working on your relationship. My professional opinion is that if you are in agreement that you both can date while you're separated, it can work, but you have just as an equal chance of not getting back together as you do getting back together. You just have to be aware of these elements and set those ground rules so that when you are separated, that nobody comes back with these bad feelings and they go, what? You did that? What? I didn't. And it really gets tricky from there. And then you're holding a grudge or resentment. And then when you get back together, that's a whole new load of baggage, I guess you could call it. So there's that. But the point is, when you're separated, you're going to have just as much opportunity as growing and bonding closer as you could grow apart. And that just needs to be an awareness for you. And both options are good, believe it or not. Because if you separate and you grow apart, that's probably what would happen if you stayed together anyway. That's a slight stretch on my part, but I've seen this where people have separated and they've grown together and they've bonded and they've come back together as a new couple. But I've also seen that, oh, we're separated and I'm happier. Oh, I'm happier too. And then they drift apart and it still works out better because the compatibility just wasn't there, or at least not fully. And that's just it. You know, you can be in love and happy and so connected to another person, and they could feel the same way about you, but there can still be compatibility issues. When I was married and the problems in our relationship weren't so prevalent, there were still compatibility issues that bothered me, and I'm sure bothered her too. And as the relationship grew on and the issues came up, the incompatibility became more and more prevalent, and we eventually split and divorced. Now, what's interesting is that my wife and I did exactly what you're talking about. She separated and went to find her passion for life again and figure her life out with the full intention of getting back together with me. So she moved out. I stayed where I was, and it was going to be about 10 months before we get back together. Huge amount of time. But we just wanted to make this work. But after several months of us being apart, the thing I just described, where I fell more in love with her and was more connected with her than anything, and was getting over my judgment issues and was doing a lot of self-healing, she was growing farther and farther apart with me. But it wasn't because she was falling out of love with me. It was because she already fell out of love. She already distanced herself while we were together. It had already happened. And that's the main component of what caused us to never get back together, is that it was already too late while we were together. So that is something else to consider, is that for one of you, it may already be too late. Now, from your letter, you say we both love each other and we have a great relationship. If that's the case, then this separation should only strengthen it. I'm not saying it will. I still believe you have just as much chance of getting back together and making the strongest relationship you've ever had as you do drifting apart. But the risk is always worth it, because you find out where you are. You find out where they are, where you are, in terms of the relationship. You find out where you are in terms of wanting to be with him, and he finds out where he is in terms of wanting to be with you. And if one or both of you don't want to be with the other, then that's what was going to happen anyway. Am I 100% right about that? Honestly, it doesn't matter. Because if the relationship can't survive a voluntary separation to work on each other so you can get back together, then it probably wouldn't be able to survive other things, because there was already some sort of emotional instability of some sort. So in a nutshell, I highly encourage a separation when you've reached a standstill, when you're trying and trying and all it feels like is you're butting heads and you're walking around in the same groove over and over again, not getting anywhere. It's like a groove in a record that never ends. It just keeps going and going and going, and you can't get past it. How do you get past it? You gotta do something radical. You gotta maybe separate and then understand yourself better without that cloudiness of what the relationship was. Because it absolutely can work, or it can absolutely give you a reality check that it wasn't meant to be. So my answer to you is yes, this can work, and in many cases, when it does work and the couple stays together, it's a lot stronger. And in some cases, there's a realization that happens and you go, oh, this wasn't meant to be, because now I am happier without you. And if that realization comes up, then better to know that and do something about it in yourself than to go back into it and pretend nothing's wrong. That's my opinion. I hope this helps you, Sarah. Thank you so much for writing. And let me see if I can fit another quick one in. I think I have time. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Let's try Ask Paul again, number two. I'm not going to read you the whole email because it's a little long, but it. She basically asks about birth order and how that changes your life in ways. How does birth order affect how we see ourselves relative to others? And that's kind of an ambiguous question, but I'm going to do my best to answer it. And she also asks something about when you're in a long-term relationship, does that set the standard for a successful relationship and keep you from being open and accepting of new relationships, especially as you age? I'll get to that in a moment. Let's talk about birth order. I don't really have too much of an opinion on birth order. I will say this, as the middle child, I am probably the most even-tempered. So maybe that has something to do with it. I don't know. There were two older siblings and two younger siblings, actually three, if you count the step-parents and such. But like my younger sister, she's also very even-tempered, and my younger brother is also very even-tempered. So maybe it started with me, and I don't know if I had any influence or it was just the way it happened. We were all pretty much even-tempered after the two that came out. Now, with my older siblings, one of them sort of acted like a parent to me. And I can see this happening often, is that when you have an older brother or sister and the mom is busy, doing something else, working, taking care of other children, cleaning the house, or, you know, whatever she did. If you didn't really have your mom there all the time, then an older sister could become your mom. Just like if you didn't have your dad all the time, an older brother could become your dad, or at least the feeling of having a positive male or female role model in your life. Well, not always positive, but a male or female role model in any sense in your life. And that can certainly affect your level of function or dysfunction in your life. Meaning, I like to look at the caretakers in our life and figure out who had the most influence in how we respond to the world today. How do I behave, and how was that influenced by my caretakers? Is there something that I do that's dysfunctional that was influenced at all by an older caretaker, whether it was my mom, my dad, an older brother, an older sister, what have you? Because when we're growing up, what we're doing is looking for guidance and nurturing and support. And sometimes the older people in our life are the ones that do that for us, and they're not always our parents. So that's just a perspective, an observation that you can go, you know, my oldest sister really had a big influence on my life, and she helped me cope. She did this, she did that. Or maybe she gave me a lot of things to be scared about. Maybe there's a lot of triggers that were developed because of that relationship. Or whatever. There's a lot that could have gone on. But I like to look at birth order as a way to look at your own life and go, was I affected by any of the people that were older than me? Was I affected in any way by my older brothers and sisters? Did they have an effect on the way I look at life, the way I live my life? And if that's the case, do I need to do anything about it? And sometimes you don't. Sometimes it's just what it was. You have brothers and sisters, you fought, maybe you loved them, maybe you didn't. Maybe things were great, maybe they weren't. Typically, from what I've seen, brothers and sisters, older, younger, aren't as impactful in your life when it comes to how you live your life. Sometimes they are, but typically our parents are the ones that we look to for that role modeling. But when our parents aren't there and another person steps in as that role model, it can have almost as much, if not just as much, impact in our life. So if you have any older brothers and sisters, you can go, were they a role model for me in any way? Do I do things today that maybe I learned from them? Like, for example, one of my sisters chews the skin around her cuticles. And she did that when I was very young. And I saw that one day and I was like, I wonder what she's doing. So I would look for skin around my cuticles and start chewing them. Fast forward 10 years, I've got gnarly hands and, you know, they're cracking and bleeding because I just picked this up. She acted as a role model in some way. And I picked it up because it was a stress habit, a coping mechanism for her. So it took me a while to stop chewing the skin around my fingers. It really made my hands look terrible. You know, I think I told this story before. I would put iodine on my skin and put band-aids over the iodine. And whenever I'd reach my hand up and start chewing, I would taste the iodine and go, bleh. And that did curb me from that habit. I'm not suggesting that you do this, but for me, it worked. But that is something that I picked up from an older sibling. I don't blame her for that. I just saw it and picked it up. I think that that's what happens is when you're in a family, regardless of your birth order, you pick up certain habits, certain behaviors, and then you bring them into your life and they become a part of you. And then you might even forget where you picked it up. But when I look back and think about my sisters and my brothers, what do I do that's very similar to what they did or what rubbed off on me from them? And things like that pop up. So I don't really have too much of an opinion on how birth order affects anything except in how they acted as role models for us. And also how they acted as rule makers too, as far as disciplining and bullying and other things like that, that really could have affected us. But what happens is that when you're around people for a long time, they rub off on you anyway. And that could be friends, family, coworkers, anyone in your life that eventually rubs off on you and creates some sort of behavior. But it typically happens when you're younger. So when you have siblings, the behavior that becomes most prevalent in your adult life was almost always learned when you were a child. Not always, but almost always. So there's my thought on that. I don't know if that helps you, but that's my thought on birth order. Maybe I'll read about it someday and study about it one day and form an opinion, but that's all I have for now. Now, the second part of this question has to do with being in a long-term relationship. She said she was in a long-term relationship with a narcissist. They broke up, and now they're, you know, they get along well. But she has this weird standard about what a successful relationship means. Well, there's two things I have to say about that. One, it doesn't surprise me that you're friends with your ex who was a narcissist, because I found that, you know, not necessarily full narcissist, but emotionally manipulative people, narcissists, on the verge of sociopathic, are usually make very good friends. They like to hang out, you laugh, you talk, everything's good. But a lot of the times make terrible romantic partners. They don't stay faithful, they lie, they toy with your emotions, they abuse. I've seen that over and over again, but they make great friends. This is why it's sometimes hard to get out of an emotionally abusive relationship, because all your friends don't believe what they hear that you're saying about the person. What? Bill's like that? That's not true. You're the one that must be crazy. I mean, that I hear that kind of stuff. It's like, I don't see that in Bill or Jennifer or whatever their name is. I don't see that at all. That's because in a relationship, they are totally different than they are in a friendship. So it doesn't surprise me that you can become friends, because they're fun to be around. They're friendly. They're generous sometimes and accommodating, and they just seem to have all the right qualities. But as soon as you get into a romantic relationship, oh, that doesn't turn out so well. And there's a lot of pain and there's a lot of turmoil, and you're looking for an exit and you can't figure out what went wrong. Just the way it is. I've seen it over and over again, unfortunately. So there's that. Now, the second part of your question has to do with maybe standardizing what a long, successful relationship is. The only answer I have to that is this show, I talk about a successful relationship in this show really comes down to, I mean, many things, but one main thing is that it's supporting each other's happiness. If your partner supports your happiness, supports your path, supports what you're doing in life, and you do the same for them, that can be a very powerful, strong relationship. If they don't, then it doesn't work. And like an umbrella, that covers a lot of ground. Because if your partner starts lying, does lying support your happiness? Does lying support your idea of a good, healthy relationship? I don't think it does. Or if they yell at you because, whatever, the house is a mess, does that support your happiness? That doesn't make me happy. If my girlfriend yells at me, I'd be like, whoa, you're yelling. This is not, I mean, I'm not really saying this in my head. But when I look back at it, I go, wait, that doesn't support my happiness. Of course, we'll talk it out and we'll talk it through and everything will be fine after. But if it was a continuous thing, if it was a pattern, it was always yelled at or always painted in a corner or something that I just felt like my boundaries kept getting crossed, then I'd say, whoa, you need to back off. This isn't working. How does that support my happiness when I'm doing my best to support your happiness? So that's where I go with any type of standardization. If I were to standardize what makes a good relationship, does that person support my path? Does that person support my happiness? Does that person meet me where I am, or do they try to change me? These are bigger picture things. It's not about that person loves sci-fi and I love Westerns. It doesn't come down to that. It can sometimes. I mean, that can be a deal breaker for people. But let's look at the bigger picture. Do our values align? Does he treat the waitress kindly? Does he treat his mom kindly? Or, you know, not just men, women too. Does she treat all her kids fairly? Does she express herself when she's angry? Or does she hold it in? I mean, these are little things that you look for. What do they do with other people? And how do they treat other people? What did they do in their last relationship? Maybe when you talk about your last relationship, are they putting the other person down and all they can think about is how terrible they were? Or are they saying, you know, I had a lot to learn myself in that last relationship, and this is what I learned, and this is what I learned, and this is what I learned. And yeah, she got angry all the time, and sometimes I deserved it, and sometimes I didn't. Is there more of a fair analysis of the last relationship? Or was it all their fault and nothing you could do was right, and you stuck around and you made everything wonderful for them and they made everything terrible for you? I mean, that may all be true. But to come out of that with no responsibility for your role, even if your role was just staying in a bad relationship, not making the choice to leave, to not have that responsibility where you can talk fairly that, yes, that person had a lot of problems and put them on me, and I had these problems too, and these are the things I'm healing from. When you can find that in a partner, yeah, I had a lot to learn. This is what I learned from my last relationship. And yeah, she had her problems, but so did I. Obviously, I attracted that. I mean, boy, that's healthy conversation when you can have conversations like that. But if they're all about bashing their ex, you just have to be careful. For example, when my girlfriend was dating, before we ever met, she met a guy that said, you know, I want full custody of my kids. And what I'm going to do is just say, I'm going to take my wife to court and I'm going to keep fighting her until she's broke and I have full custody of them. And my girlfriend was like, ouch, if that's how he talks about his ex, that's the kind of person he is. He's willing to take his kids away from their mom? I mean, that was important to her. And that was one of the deal breakers for her, is that she heard the stuff he was talking about. And I think the problem happens when you hear this stuff and you either go, wow, what if that happened to me? Or you go, wow, I'm so glad he doesn't love his ex anymore, so I'm not afraid that he'll go back to her. I mean, think about that. Sometimes we do that. Sometimes we go, oh, he's talking so badly about his ex, I guess there's no chance they'll get back together. That makes me feel good. That means he's in this relationship 100%. I'm all about that. But turn it around. Think about how they're talking about other people, how they're treating other people. If that's in them, that's in them. That's there. That's going to happen. That's going to show up in your relationship. That has to be on your mind. You can't just look at it from one way and go, oh, if they don't like that person, that makes our relationship better. No, I think you have to look at how do they treat other people. That's important. How do they treat their ex? That's important. You know, you could meet someone that admits that they treated their ex badly. I admitted that. I admitted that on the air several times. I treated my ex badly. And this is what I learned. And this is what I'm doing to heal. And this is what I've healed from. And this is what I'm still working on. That has to be prevalent in people when you're starting a new relationship. You want to hear this kind of stuff. You don't want to hear this one-sidedness. She was awful. Or he was terrible. He did nothing but this and this and this and this and this. And I stayed with him for 20 years. He was awful, awful, awful. My question to you would be, if he was so awful, why did you stay with him for so long? And that might not be a question that is pleasant to hear, because there might be some bitterness there. But neither here nor there. The idea is that it doesn't matter if you're 22 or 52. When you're starting a new relationship, look at it from the perspective is, how do they treat others? How do they talk about their ex? Are they supporting your happiness? Do they support your path? Or are they trying to change you? That's a big flag right there. And then just go forward with it. And you know what? Take your time. Don't fall in love immediately. Because once you fall in love, you put those blinders on and everything they do is fine. You don't want that. You want to fall in love gradually, slowly. Keep getting little signals that it's okay to move forward with this relationship. Oh, they did something good. They did something good. And then as soon as your warning flag comes up, stop that falling in love process and assess it. And look for another one and look for another one. If there's no others, then you can start the love process again. The falling in love process. But just take it slowly, because things that are worth having are worth taking slowly and figuring out if they're right. Because if you fall in love and you get connected and it turns out to be wrong, can you look back and go, well, I gave it time. I did my best. I did everything I could. Or can you go, we fell in love right away. Within 3 days, we were off to Maui and spending time together. You just have to approach it gradually and see where it goes. And I will say this, once you're in a place where you're more and more healed in yourself, emotionally speaking, you can see the warning signs faster. When you go on your first date, you're going to see a warning sign and go, whoa, don't want that in my life. Because it won't come from a place of desperation. It'll come from a place of, I honor myself and I'll only let certain people in my life. you're either going to gain my trust or you're not. You become more aware and you're attracted to less dysfunctional people. When you're healed inside, you're going to be attracted to less dysfunctional people. So work on yourself, heal yourself, keep moving in that direction, and then take everything else I said and bring that into your upcoming relationships too. So thanks for writing. I didn't even give you a name because you put no name. So I'm going to call you No Name. Thanks for writing. And thanks for listening to another episode. We'll be right back. I'm going to close the show, say some final words, and then we'll talk again next week. Be right back. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Overwhelmed Brain. I want to thank Audible. Get your 30-day trial today. Go to audible.com/brain. If you want to listen to it, Audible has it. With an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, news, comedy, and more, you'll find what you're looking for. Get your free audiobook and your 30-day trial today by signing up at audible.com/brain. And the reviews are coming in. It's the A to Z of Self-Empowerment, The Overwhelmed Brain book. You can go to Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com and pick up where I leave off every week. Pick up the book where I take almost everything I teach on the show and condense it into a book so you can carry it around with you and circle things and highlight things. There's exercises in there. You're going to love it. Go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble and pick up The Overwhelmed Brain, Personal Growth for Critical Thinkers today. And thank you to the amazing patron members that support this show and get all the bonuses that we have in the patron program. If you're interested yourself in those bonuses, go to patron.theoverwhelmedbrain.com. And finally, thank you to Kevin McLeod of Incompetech.com for some of the music transitions in The Overwhelmed Brain. And to close the show, I want to share with you my political views. No, I'm kidding. But I do have a political comment to make because the presidential inauguration in the U.S. Happened today. And all I want to say is this. Let's hope that Donald Trump is a great president and that not only does he listen to his supporters, but he also listens to his non-supporters. That's my hope. Because if that happens, if he listens to both sides and can make a decision from there, then maybe this country will be great. I don't think it's not great, but let's keep it great. Let's hope Donald Trump can keep it great. That's all I have to say about the presidential inauguration today, except one more thing. I'll say one more thing. And it's this. If you are worried about what might happen because someone is in charge of the country, if you're in the U.S. or even if you're not in the U.S., I mean, he's going to be talking with all the other countries too. But if you're at all worried, at least save your worry until it's real. This is something that I've seen over and over again, that Donald Trump's going to do this and he's going to repeal healthcare and he's going to bring back Roe versus Wade. And I see all these arguments, and there's a lot of real fear that a lot of people have. But let's not go there until we're there. Even today, after the first steps to repealing healthcare took place, it still hasn't affected most people here and now. Maybe by the time you hear this, it might have. But as of this recording, on Friday, January 20th, 2017, the first steps have been taken. But I'm still here. I'm still paying what I did for healthcare before. So really, there's nothing to worry about today. That doesn't mean I shouldn't take action. That doesn't mean that I shouldn't write to my congressman or whatever I feel the need to do. But it just means it hasn't happened today. There's a process going on. There's always a process of something going on. But until it comes to fruition, do your best to save your worry or bad feelings until it actually affects you. Again, it doesn't mean if you really want to take action that you don't take action, because that kind of stuff can inspire people to take action. And if you really are worried, then do what you can to take action. But if you know you're not going to do anything, if you know you're not going to picket or write to your congressman or do something that gets the word out there in other ways, but until it affects you, don't be affected. I know that's hard, I know, because there's a lot of worries today, and you don't know what's going to happen. And this could be with any president, really. Any president that went into office, you have no idea what's going to happen. You just hope that they do the right thing for everyone. Which is why I go back, don't only listen to your supporters, listen to your non-supporters too. Because I think that's what a good president will do. And then he can make decisions based on the data and the opinions of everyone. And if you're worried about anything, yes, there's a time to worry. I can't believe I'm saying this. But there is a time to worry. There is a time to feel anxiety. But don't let it happen until it's really real. When it's in your face and you now have no choice. Hope that makes sense. I hope that doesn't piss anyone off. Because talking about political stuff can be very hairy nowadays, especially. But it's a good idea to remind yourself, hey, today is today. Tomorrow is tomorrow. Today I'm enjoying time with my kids, with my mom, with my partner, with myself. I can enjoy this day. I can choose to enjoy it. And if that happens tomorrow, then I'll deal with it then. It's all part of the anti-anxiety process where you're worried about something that may or may not happen. Well, you might say, I'm worried about something that I know will happen. Yes, but it's not happening right now unless it is. Right now, I'm talking. You're not listening to the news, you're listening to me. Now, you might have the news on in another room, but still, it's not happening until it's happening. You remember when 9/11 happened, right? September 11th, 2001. When it was happening, then I felt the fear. Then I felt the anxiety. Then I felt the sadness. It all happened. But before it happened, I didn't feel this stuff. Now, most people didn't know it was going to happen. But imagine if you stopped watching news and you didn't know what was going to happen. You might feel that way leading up to what might happen. I'm not saying to do that because if you're an action taker and all that stuff, that's neither here nor there. I don't personally watch too much news. I get a briefing every now and then and I keep up, but I try not to embroil myself in all the news that might make me feel like the world's coming to an end or my world is going to crash down on me. Because what are you programming your subconscious mind with? Is it worry and fear all the time? I hope not. But if it is, maybe you can handle it. I know that too much for me is too much for me. If I have the news on all the time, it's just too much. Where's the good news? Where's 100 people trying to save a dog that fell through the ice? You know, that kind of good news where everyone spends thousands of dollars and spends their time and energy doing something good. So that's all I want to say. Whether it's this presidential inauguration or something else going on in your life that you're really concerned about, what I want you to do is go forward with an open mind and step into your power and be firm in your decisions and actions so that you can create the life you want. Always take steps to grow and evolve. You are powerful beyond measure. And above all, and this is something I absolutely know to be true about you, you are amazing.